first time.
Yeah.
I had to lobby him. And at his retirement function when he was when he left the Senate, I was one of the roasters at his
great. Right?
And it was and we've always had a very cordial, good relationship. And then my daughter went down there and went to work, and he had a good relationship with her. And I probably never agreed with him on anything politically.
Yeah.
But we always were, you know, I would almost say friends. You know, it was certainly a friendly relationship.
Yeah.
When I used to lobby him, my wife and I would take he and his current girlfriend out for dinner and a Blazer game or something. And it was always pleasant.
Yeah.
I always had a good time with him.
Yeah, the so group I was just talking to was kind of, they're trying to make it the equivalent of the Arlington Club, but for women.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Portlandia. It's been around since the mid-80s when they were kicked out of clubs like that. They had Sylvia Hayes has come and talked to them. Rosie Sizer, who's no longer the chief of police. There was another one as well. So they were all worried about my job. People didn't to talk to them, and then, whoops, they're gone. So, it's interesting. The friend thing, when I was talking to Jerry Thompson, Vic's chief of staff, just like a month ago, so it was after the Oregonian had called for his resignation, but they were at something in Salem. And they realized they'd known each other since like 1976.
Yeah.
And had never had a picture taken together. And so they had a picture taken together, and she was showing it to people, and he looked great. It's a fantastic picture. And she told them at the time, she said, you know, John, I'm just mad and I'm sad.
Well.
And he got a real hangdog look and, you know, didn't say much. But
yeah. I'm in the same boat. I mean, I'm very sad that it happened to him and that it happened to state government. But he's got to pay. If he did wrong, he's got to pay for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and he enabled her. You know, I mean, I've got my own thoughts about her, you know, but, and they aren't good.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he enabled her.
He never told that other side of the story.
Yeah.
It's like, geez Louise, come on, guys.
So I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm reserving my any. I get asked all the time what I think about it. I say, well, you know what? He hasn't been indicted for anything yet.
Give me a few facts.
You know, that's right. Give me some facts.
Yeah.
And I'll wait till the reports come out. If he gets indicted, then he's going to have to pay for his wrongdoings. But don't be burying the guy. Don't be piling on.
Yeah.
You know, I don't, as a former politician, I don't like that.
Yeah, it reminded me of Watergate.
I
remember people were saying, well, you know, what do you think? It's like, well, we need to see some facts.
Yep.
Were laws actually broken? You know, what happened? And
exactly.
At this point, there's nothing.
That's right.
There's nothing.
It may not be something you like, but that doesn't make it against the law.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, it's too bad, and I wish him the best. And I sent him a note and said that. So
yeah.
I'm just going to sit and wait.
Yeah.
I feel bad about it.
Just hope he doesn't recycle that in the dump in Bend or the police.
What the hell
are going
was he doing over there?
Well, they're probably at her house.
Oh, she still has a residence over there.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Well, the immediate thought is, oh, yeah, he's packing stuff over to Deschutes County to get rid of it. I'm thinking, well, not that.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
So, let me tell you what's going on.
Okay.
A year ago in October, Victor asked me to write his biography.
Great.
And he's been giving his stuff to Pacific for about the past 4.5 years.
Right, I understood
so
that.
So I've got the archive over there, and I've known him for a long time anyway. But I worked with the archivists. We would go to his office. I would ask him, he'd have a box. Usually when you get an archive, you get everything at once. Not with Victor. So he'd have a box, and I talked to him about that, and we recorded those conversations and things. And so over the course of him knowing the work that I do, but then also this, he came to the decision that he wanted me to write his biography. And he said, you know, the condition I gave him is, I want to tell your story, warts and all, and there's no restrictions on anything in his archive, which is extremely rare. I want to put you in the context of the times. I've been reading the Bob Straub biography, and it's good, but it just focused on Bob. There's nothing in there. Boy, at the same time, Wayne Morse got knocked off by Bob Packwood.
Right.
That's totally missing. Those contexts just aren't there. And that's exactly what he wanted. So, off we go. I was able to interview him several times before he died. So I've got that good stuff going. And so I'm working through the lists. started with a year ago. He sent me a list. There had been an attempt to write a biography about 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And it didn't work. He sent me the list that that biographer had worked on, and he went through and wrote D for dead and F for frail. So I've been hitting the Fs, working my way down. But it's sad because this person is supposed to have interviewed Mark Hatfield, and we don't even know if there were any notes or anything. So, you know, that kind of stuff is just gone.
Yeah.
But so that's basically the thing. And so I record everything. This is all archival quality. It's eventually going to go into the archives. Then I take it and, in effect, snip it up by conversation. So I have my own bibliography going, and off we go and try to figure out who was this guy, Vicatia, and what did he do?
Yeah, I'm thinking, when you said warts and all, my guess is you're not going to find a lot of warts.
Yeah.
On Vic. You know, this is the kind of guy he was.
Yeah, exactly. I did find one that I'm going to be chasing down on one of his Middle East trips. A rich Syrian guy came up to him and said, I want you to go buy whatever you want in the bazaar, and I'll pay for it. Mm-hmm. And the deal is that you then, when you leave the country, send an equivalent amount of money to his daughter, because there were currency restrictions. You couldn't send.
Wow.
And so that's a nice thing to do, and I'm sure people did it, but I'm just going to be looking back at 1982, 83, 84 currency laws and see, so Vic, were you a currency smuggler?
That's interesting.
Because
yeah.
For him, that he wouldn't really bat an eye about doing something
well,
like
that. Well, I wouldn't have thought anything about it either.
Yeah,
know? I mean,
yeah.
I wouldn't have thought anything about him doing it.
Yeah, know? Yeah. So, you know, there's just little things like that. But yeah, no, it's basically getting a full picture of him as a person and as a politician. So,
good, yeah.
So,
well, I've been asked, and I have written and produced two little things that I've done on Vic.
Mm-hmm.
Since he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
One was just a brief thing that those of us who were on the Oregon State Capitol Foundation did for our newsletter,
mm-hmm.
and that was only a couple, three paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to deliver a speech, 10-minute speech, on my relationship with Vic,
mm-hmm.
Which I did. And I brought those things along.
Fantastic.
And they tell... I mean, kind of my personal feelings about Vic and my personal experience with him. Of course, I had more experiences with him that are contained in those items, but nevertheless, that is there, and I can give that to you or
read
it to you or whatever you want me to do.
Yeah, no. If I could have him, that'd be great.
Yeah.
I just put him in the bibliography.
I think this are you familiar with, I'm not pressing, but are you familiar with, the organization called Trumpeters?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
The speech was to that group.
Oh, okay.
And it's and this, we kind of hold the stuff that we do there close.
Right.
And so when I give it to you, I give it to you with that in mind.
Yeah, no problem.
I'm not saying redact anything. I'm just saying that
we
don't go out and say, hey, this is what's said at Trumpeters.
Right, yeah.
But anyway,
No problem. Yep.
So this is that speech to Trumpeters.
Fantastic.
And then this is a copy of what was in the...
Great.
And that's, you know, so...
Yeah.
I just thought I'd bring those along. It might help because...
That's fantastic.
Because I did have... I did have some close times with Vic. I think he considered me a friend. And
mm-hmm.
I consider him a friend and Dolores mm-hmm. a friend. And my wife is involved in that too.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as being one of his close confidants, I was not.
Yeah. It's interesting because the last time I interviewed Jerry Thompson was like all hell broke loose with governor with calling Kate back on a Wednesday. I interviewed Jerry on that Thursday.
Oh, yeah.
And I was checking email and everything. And I went to, so I was interviewing her in Salem. I went to lunch a block and a half from the Capitol. I checked everything. We were fine. I went to a funeral in Lake Oswego. I got back here and everything had exploded.
Yeah.
Because that's when Tina Kotek and Peter Courtney and Ted Wheeler all called for him. But because of Kitzhaber the day before, my first question to Jerry was, so we're looking at Kitzhaber, who clearly has no one to talk to. You know, it appears to be Sylvia Hayes and his attorney. So who did Vic talk to? And she talked about he had a couple of close friends that he grew up with. But when he said his leadership style was, I want to be part of the discussion, but he then made the decisions by himself, yeah. sometimes behind closed doors. So he had that style as well. So.
Yeah, well, he was an interesting guy, and I played cards with him. I played golf with him.
Mm-hmm.
We used to have a retreat that was called Tri-P, and it was press, politicians, and public affairs. So it was lobbyists, elected officials, and people from the press.
Yeah.
And this was back before the press got holier than thou. And
right.
Didn't want, you know. Right. And we used to go up to Timothy Lake.
Oh, yeah?
For a couple, 3 nights, and we'd play a round of golf going up, and then we'd have a horseshoe tournament.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there was a lot of booze
mm-hmm.
and a lot of card playing and just socializing, and it was great. And Vic would come to that, and it's in that speech. He would come to that, make an appearance at least, but sometimes he'd come and stay.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd play cards, he'd play golf going up there, and then he always presented the trophies of the horseshoe tournament,
mm-hmm.
and they'd have dinner with the guys. And the thing that I always admired about him was that when he was there, he was just one of the guys. But
yeah.
it was a crowd that he knew, that we all knew he was the governor. I mean,
right.
there wasn't any question about it. Everybody had respect for him. But in this environment, I mean, he was just kind of one of the boys.
Yeah.
Nobody favored him in the card games or in the golf game.
Yeah. yeah. And you don't get the sense that Kitzhaber did that kind of stuff at all.
Oh, I don't. I know. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't even know
of any fishing buddies or anything.
No, I think he fished alone. But
yeah.
I don't know if John... I just don't know if he had any, you know, friends that he would, you know, socialize with like that.
Mm-hmm.
He had, I know some of his early staffers were very close to him,
mm-hmm.
and they were together a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But when I think back, well, they were together in the Capitol building, or they were together at political functions.
Mm-hmm.
Did I ever see him anywhere else?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Just job, job, job. Yeah,
and I, you know, and in those days, John was not married,
mm-hmm.
and he hadn't been married to Sharon.
Mm-hmm.
He hadn't been married to her yet,
mm-hmm.
and you know, so it was he was you know, kind of a loner.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's Kitzhaber. It's not
yeah,
Vic.
Exactly. Vic. So tell me, when were you first elected?
Well, I was elected in 72 election,
uh-huh.
and was a freshman representative from Klamath Falls.
So did you know him, or if you were from Klamath Falls?
At that time,
okay.
that was my district, was
okay.
53 in Klamath Falls. At that time, 53.
I was right over the hill in Medford.
Yeah, okay, well, so. My district in Klamath Falls was basically Klamath, it was the first, 72 was the first election for single-member
right.
districts, okay?
Right.
And so, it was a district that was basically the city of Klamath Falls and the suburban area. And it was basically an urban district in eastern Oregon.
Yeah.
You know, and it was small compared to all the other guys in eastern Oregon that had vast
exactly.
districts, you know. But
yeah.
but nevertheless, it was eastern Oregon, so I was part of that crowd. But anyway, that was elected and served in 73, 75, 77,
mm-hmm.
and then 79, and I was the minority leader in 79.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the minority the whole time.
They
took control in 73.
Yeah.
And so Vic was the minority leader. Was he the minority leader in 73 in the Senate?
70, he was 75 and 77, I know. I'm not sure. I think he was, but I'm
he
not
might
sure.
have been.
I'm just putting together, I was trying to find blue books.
Yeah.
At Powell's, but they don't sell them anymore.
Well, so. I've got them back there if you need to look at them.
Okay.
I've got them from, well, I don't know from when forward, but certainly
yeah.
from 73 forward.
Yeah.
But Vic was minority leader, and you know, in those couple of those times, like in 77, I think, there were only six Republican
yeah.
senators.
There were six, and there were only seven the other time.
Yeah,
so.
And so there weren't, I mean, I don't remember us interfacing with the Senate a lot other than
mm-hmm.
to socialize.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I interfaced with Jason Bowe and Debs Potts and some of the leading D's
right.
as much as I ever did, you know, some of the Republicans. But nevertheless, I didn't have a great deal of interaction with Vic as a legislator.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I was the minority leader, and I was new, and most all the leadership around there was new, mm-hmm. And Vic was the new governor. Mm-hmm. We interfaced quite a bit in the 79 session.
Yeah.
And then we had some significant legislation that was enacted that session that Vic was involved in because we had to get it past him.
Yeah.
And one, not the least of which, was the property tax relief plan at that time,
right,
which contained the kicker.
Yeah.
And in any event, that was a package of bills, and Vic signed them all but one, and he let that one go through without his signature. He didn't mm-hmm. veto anything. Mm-hmm. But there was a camaraderie between Vic and Jason Bow, who had been, who was Senate president for a number of years, mm-hmm. and Debs and John Burns and a bunch of other Democrat senators mm-hmm. that were in that old coalition. And there was a real camaraderie amongst those guys. And mm-hmm. so they knew how to work together to get things done, and so you didn't see the vetoes.
Yeah,
they worked it out ahead of time, even yeah. though it was the D's trying to work something yeah. through a Republican governor. It was a very interesting time, mm-hmm. and when I think back, there were they were very competent legislators. They were
yeah.
damn good.
Yeah,
they knew how to play the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Vic knew how to play the game as governor.
Yep,
he was good at it, and I think. Well, history shows, and not too much criticism of Vic and how he handled himself during those times. And he didn't have necessarily a lot of easy time there either. I mean, we went through some rough economic times. When he was
yeah, there. Yeah, yeah. I've heard the 79 session described as kind of the apogee of good tax news, but the tax revolt in California was just kind of on everybody's mind.
It was
for everything.
It was, and that had been pushing the legislature for more than 79. It's that tax revolt. We'd had a number of efforts to limit the property taxes in Oregon before then.
Yeah,
and then we headed it off in 79 with the package that we passed, which was quite an interesting package when you look back at it. But you talk about the times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you could never do that today.
Right.
Nor would you want to do it today.
Yeah.
But at the times, we were looking at, I did a paper on the kicker not long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to recall the number, but I believe in the budget, the projected budget for 79-81, during the 79 session, we had something like a $700 million surplus.
Right. Which even today would be huge.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But what happened, and we gave it most of it away.
Yeah.
We gave it back to the taxpayer.
Yeah.
But what happened then was that the economy turned to crap right after that.
Yeah.
Had we known that was going to happen, we'd never pass those bills.
Yeah.
But we did. We passed them.
Yeah.
And it was a good package, and it was well received. The public loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And, obviously Vic didn't like parts of it.
Yeah.
but he let it go without a signature.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was the tax legislation in 79 was probably the premier issue that session.
Yeah. So talk to me about the dynamic of working with the governor's office. And the reason I ask is I talked to Hardy Myers. And Hardy was saying that when you were there, he was dealing with you, the leadership. But after you resigned, then he wasn't able to work with whoever came in, and so he was working much more with Vic, as kind of working with Vic to go to the Republicans like that. So talk to me about working with Vic, your position in the legislature, and then working with the governor and how that all fit together.
Well, that was a good. Those years right in there were a pretty good time for Republicans. Even though we were in a minority in the mm-hmm. legislature, we could see light at the end of the tunnel. We were working toward regaining the majority,
mm-hmm.
and we were making progress.
Mm-hmm.
There was a unity that existed there that I don't believe exists today. There was a camaraderie that was there at the time that I don't believe exists today. And I think that, I mean, certainly between the D's and the R's, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it's near as good between members of the Republican caucus as it was then. But we were riding high. We felt good. We wanted to work together. The Republican legislators wanted to work together with the new governor, and you know, we wanted him to do well, and we wanted to look good because we wanted to win the next election.
Yeah.
And so everything was kind of positive. There really wasn't much negative. And I can give you some, for instances, like when my good friend Bob Smith, who was the Senate Minority Leader, and I got at odds over a bill that one of my caucus members was not helping him with in his committee, and I was pulling for my caucus member, but Bob and I were good buddies, and in any event, guess who I get a call from? Vic Attia. How about coming down to the office? So I go to the office, and there sits Bob Smith and Vic Attia. I don't know who else was in there. Not many people. But they wanted to know if, you know, and it wasn't kind of an intimidating, other than me being in the governor's office, because I knew he was trying to help Bob Smith, his old Senate buddy. But he wasn't using a heavy hand on me, you know. But after the conversation and his request and so forth, I felt okay about trying to heal it up with Bob and going his way on the bill. But my problem was having to go back to my caucus member, and who I had a lot of respect for, and believe me, I was sensitive. I didn't want any of my caucus members getting angry with me, nor did I want them to have any trouble in their districts. But in any event, I was able to go back and patch that up and get it done. But I always think back to that about how Vic, he wasn't above calling in his friends and saying, come on, you know, let's make peace. Let's get this figured out. And it wasn't with a heavy hand. I mean, some guys would just come in and say, you know, here's what you got to do. And please understand. The negative, if you don't. But it was, he never came out and said, well, what do I have to do to get you to change your mind? He never, because I didn't want him to have to do that. And it was just kind of there was a lot of unspoken goodwill amongst all of us at the time. And so we tried to work together. And so we did. We got it worked out. And that was just one little instance, but it had something to do with cattle and grazing, I think.
All the good stuff.
Yeah. But anyway, that's just one little experience. But we had a good relationship with Vic. I could get in to see him anytime I wanted to. Nobody ever stopped me from getting in to see him when I was the minority leader ever. And I didn't wear that out. And we actually appointed somebody in the caucus to be the liaison with the governor's office, which meant he would go work with the governor's staff primarily. But we used to have, you know, regular conversations, and it was just easy communication. And we didn't disagree on issues much. Once in a while, Vic came from Beaverton, and I was raised in Beaverton, so I understood. But when you're coming from Klamath Falls and Eastern Oregon, you don't always see the issues the same from over east of the mountains as you do over here. You know that. And anyway, Vic understood all that because he'd been around there a long time, and we were always able to work it out. You know, we were always able to work it out. But in those days, too, we had, you know, we had an Eastern Oregon caucus that was about half Democrats.
So
we would meet regularly, and we would vote together on the floor. And the D's and the R's would vote together on Eastern Oregon issues. But we never really, it never really got me at odds with Vic or, you know, the other Republican leadership. And that's probably because most of those Democrat legislators from Eastern Oregon thought like Republicans anyway. But it was, I don't know how else to explain it to you. It was a good time. The thing that is different now, and I'm not bragging up minority leader, because we always joke about the awesome power of the minority leader, you know, which is pretty much that much. Although, that session, because of Hardy Myers, in large part, and his desire to bring the minority more into the fold, we were able to negotiate. Our caucus and their caucus, and Hardy and I, were able to negotiate a whole lot of concessions to the minority that didn't exist before that session and have never existed since that session. As an example, one of them was that the minority leader could appoint his own caucus members to a conference committee.
Oh my, yeah.
And so I was pretty good at appointing myself and others to these conference committees where it was a bill that we did not want, and we tangled them up, tied them up, killed them.
Yeah.
And but Hardy was okay with that. And I had a lot of respect for Hardy as speaker, and we got along great. And I think that the minority leader at that point, and probably prior to that point too, was truly the leader of the Republican caucus, was truly the representative of the Republican caucus. And when it came to negotiations, and if they wanted to do it behind closed doors, and there was only going to be one from the caucus in there, it was the minority leader, and you'd go in and you'd represent your caucus. And I don't know that it's that the caucus is quite that solid or significant nowadays. And certainly the majority leader in those days was also more significant, I believe. Because nowadays the majority leaders defer in the Senate to the president.
Yeah.
And in the House, the Speaker.
Yeah.
But the minority leaders don't have that, so you know, they're kind of the ones. So
yeah, Barbara Roberts describes being a majority leader as she was in there in those meetings with Vic.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's the way it worked.
And in those days, it's true.
Yeah.
And, you know, now, I staffed a number of years since then and sat in those meetings as a person alongside the Speaker. You know, the majority leaders are in there, and they have something to say, but it's not the same. And certainly with the minority leaders, it depends on the minority leader, I guess. There've been good ones and bad ones. Larry Campbell was a very good minority leader. He parlayed into being speaker, you know, ultimately. But there have been some that have not been as good in those situations. But nevertheless, I'm not putting down anybody, and I'm not blowing up anybody. I'm just saying the times were different.
Yeah.
The politics was different.
Yeah.
It was different. And Vic fit right in. I mean, that was the environment he was good in. And if he knew people were working at it and getting along, I mean, were respectful of each other, he could climb into the den with them and bring them together. And did.
Yeah. So when did you resign?
I resigned at the end of 79, became a registered lobbyist on the January 1 of 80. With my company, it was a telephone company at the time.
And so Hardy was saying it was GTE.
It was Pacific Northwest Bell at the time.
Yeah.
And so it was a promotion for me, and I'm staring down the barrel of four little kids coming up to be educated, and I thought, should I be a politician or should I be a telephone man? I've been a telephone man for 20 years. I haven't been a politician that long, and I don't see, you know, I may have aspirations, but so do a lot of these other guys. And, I think I'd probably better take care of my family. I took the job, and it was a significant promotion for me to come up here and be one of the lobbyists. And, and then eventually my boss retired, and I became the lead lobbyist. And it was a good career, the last 17 years of which were lobbying.
Yeah. So were you immediately lobbying down in Salem, or did they...
Immediately, and that's a transition.
Yeah, but...
All of a sudden, instead of walking in as the enemy, you're walking in with the company's, or the PAC's checkbook at a Democrat fundraiser, and the Democrats are looking at you like,
we just saw you, didn't
we? Do we trust you, or don't we trust you? But fortunately, I think, you know, speaking for me, I had a decent reputation in the legislature. I never double-crossed anybody, so... Maybe there was a little doubt in the beginning, but it didn't take me long to earn my way into the Democrats' hearts as much as you can. But I never concealed my Republicanism, and I never concealed the fact that I'd been labeled a Republican leader once, and they all knew it. But you know, in those days, you're getting probably 20% turnover in the legislature every 2 years anyway.
Yeah.
So it didn't take long, and they're mostly all new guys.
Yeah.
And gals.
So from that perch, talk me through your observations as 79 turns into 80. Paul Volcker decides that interest rates are just going to go poof, kind of mid to late 79. So the economy starts shifting pretty radically. By 80, there's special sessions. 81, and then as we go into 82, you know, our economy just falls through the floor.
Oh, yeah, man. It was bad, not good.
So it's worse than what we just went through.
I think so, too.
Yeah, when you look at it, there's no doubt the unemployment rate was higher. Just the fact that it just destroyed the timber industry, that what we have now is basically the rebuild from that, and it hasn't gone much further.
There were a lot of, everybody was riding high. There was a lot, as you probably know, there were a lot of enormous subdivisions being built around here because mm-hmm. the money was just flowing for it. And then all of a sudden it stopped. And all these subdivisions, which were middle-income mm-hmm. family homes, mm-hmm. stopped and sat there for, you know, some of them for 4 or 5 years before they ever went back in and finished the houses. And a whole lot of people went broke because of that. And a whole lot of jobs down the toilet. It was not a good... I mean, we moved up, bought a new house in 80 that was already built.
Mm-hmm.
And within 2 years, it was underwater. I mean, it wasn't worth what we paid for it in 1980. And we're thinking, well, maybe this wasn't such a good idea to come up here. But nevertheless, you could see that things would eventually turn around, hopefully.
Yeah.
Which they did.
Klamath Falls, I mean, with Weyerhaeuser just cutting back and things like that.
Klamath, they had an awful time.
Yeah, just horrible.
Yeah, it was not a good time.
Yeah.
But anyway... what was your question?
Basically, so you're a lobbyist now. What were your observations about Vic's leadership as those crises just began to hit?
Well, when he came out with his income tax surtax,
mm-hmm.
I think at the time, being a Republican from Klamath Falls, I must have looked at that like, what are you, nuts?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, in the back of your mind, when you sit down and work the numbers, you think, well, maybe the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. We got to do something,
mm-hmm.
and he's smart enough to, you know, it wasn't. I don't know if he put a sunset on it, or anyway, it wasn't a permanent deal.
Right.
However they handled that at the time, and I can't remember. It's probably a sunset, but in any event, thinking, well, okay, and so I, being a new lobbyist at that time, and I probably. Wanted to just kind of watch more than I wanted to get in and mix it up. And besides, I was working on telephone company utility stuff.
Right.
You know, and it really wasn't income tax stuff. That was personal stuff.
Yeah.
But anyway, we watched him get it done.
Mm-hmm.
And so Vic Atiyah's, what people thought of him as a governor, I think went up considerably at that point in time mm-hmm. because he got this done. And got through the problem, and then, you know, the tax goes away, and things move on. And,
yeah.
And it was probably the right thing to do. And I know there was a lot of Republicans that didn't like the tax increase, but at the same time, it solved the problem. And he got support from both sides,
mm-hmm.
and so it was another example of Vic Atiyah's leadership. Because mm-hmm. that took leadership.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something, I don't know if anybody would do that today. Mm-hmm. Surtax the income
yeah.
tax.
Yeah.
You know, Tom McCall tried to raise the income tax. It didn't work for him in 73. That was the McCall tax plan. That didn't work to shift the burden from property taxes over to income taxes.
Yeah.
Didn't work for him.
Yeah.
But anyway, Vic, he did it. So I think that, and I don't know all of the like I said, I was worried about utility stuff.
Right.
And so I don't know what other bills he may have pushed during the 81 and 83 sessions
mm-hmm.
to deal with the economic times.
Mm-hmm.
There were no doubt some, but that was that income tax surtax was a big one. And it worked okay.
Yeah. So during that time, the Atiyah administration at some point decides that the main focus is no longer triage, although that's still there. you know, dealing with the timber industry collapsing and unemployment and, you know, things like the income tax surcharge. But Vic becomes Trader Vic. And he starts heading out everywhere he can find to, you know, get people here. And by 84, there's a special session to repeal the unitary tax for all the Japanese companies that have said the unitary tax, we have a problem with that.
Yeah.
So did you sense a difference in Salem as that was happening? Were people wondering, what the heck is he doing? Were people saying, oh, diversity is good? Or, you know, what
I think all that. You certainly heard the business industrial community and the Republican business community patting him on the back for trying to increase international trade and, mm-hmm. and so forth,
mm-hmm.
and getting Oregon on the map
mm-hmm.
for that. And he did that, and he deserves a lot of credit for that. And has got a lot of credit for that. But then you would also have the naysayers who are, you know, and I don't really have much truck with them, but the people that criticize public officials for traveling on the state dime and going all over the world and doing this, they just don't understand the value of it. And I think that Vic did it for the value of it. I don't think Vic was just having fun traveling around mm-hmm. the world because, you know, he made things happen with that. And most of the governors, when they go on these international trips, are not doing it to have fun.
No.
Sometimes maybe, okay, I'll give that to them, they're the governor.
Yeah.
But most of the time it's something it's aimed at international trade or mm-hmm. enhancing our state. You know,
mm-hmm.
I just came back from a 3-week trip to Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people would ask where we were from. We weren't around very many Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd say, Oregon on the Pacific coast of the USA.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see, there were a few of them that said, oh yeah, Oregon, that's Portland, eh? You know what?
Mm-hmm.
So you knew that they'd heard something, they knew mm-hmm. about it. But, you know, most of the people still were trying to picture where it was. You'd say, Seattle? Oh yeah. San Francisco? Oh yeah. It's right in between them, you know. and then they get it.
Yeah.
You know, but there were some that did know Oregon and Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to believe that if our governors, if our, you know, our trade emissaries weren't going over there and selling the state, we wouldn't be as far as we are.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's important if the future is really the Pacific Rim and our, you know, our
yeah.
trade around here, well, we have to start doing that
because
I don't know how much traveling you've done over there. I haven't done a lot, but I mean, you go into towns like Tokyo and Singapore, Bangkok, my God.
Yeah, that's 3 times the population of Oregon. Right,
whirlwind of activity.
Yeah.
And Singapore is way more modern than Portland.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you know, and you're thinking, well, okay, maybe we ought to start paying more attention.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of people back here, they don't know that. They don't. Mm-hmm. They probably don't understand it. And I'm not putting them down. I'm just saying that there's no reason why they would.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy like Vic, he really got it started. I don't know how many of the trips that any governor before him ever made, but he did, and not only to the east. I mean, he went to the Near East too.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think it's he had a lot of foresight, and
mm-hmm.
and then deserves the credit that he got with his recognition out of Portland Airport and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's good. And the governors since him have done it too. Goldschmidt was good at it, and
mm-hmm.
Kitzhaber was good at it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about Kulongoski how much he did it, but he did some. And Barbara, I'm not sure how much she did. But in any event, I think he was into it and he was good at it.
Mm-hmm. Victor himself, talking about the Republican Party, he always would refer to his principles. Here's the principles. And he did an oral history with the Oregon Historical Society about 25 years ago, early 90s. And he's talking about, because he was governor as the moral majority is beginning to come in. So when he's elected, it's kind of a twinkle in people's eye. By the time he leaves, it's a well-established, the social conservative part of the Republican Party. And then here, the real big sweep comes in the early 90s, with not just Lon Mabon, but it's that's behind the Republicans taking the House and the Senate in Oregon and things like that. And his description of it at the time, in the early 90s and then thinking back to the 80s, was that people were joining the Republican Party and then redefining what it meant to be a Republican.
I don't disagree with that.
Which frustrated him. So, you know, talk to me about him as a Republican. He hated to be called the last Republican governor.
Yeah, but he used it a lot.
He did too.
It was
no the most recent or latest, but so talk to me about him as a Republican.
Well, you'll see in my speech material there. The first time I saw Vicatia was probably in 1963 or 4, I don't know, early, because he was the state rep and for Beaverton. Mm-hmm. And I was a member of the Beaverton JCs. And he gave a speech to the Beaverton JCs downtown Beaverton. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I ever came in contact with him. And I was a Democrat at the time. But I liked him. And I probably didn't see him again for a long time, probably for 10 more years until I got involved in politics. And I made the conversion to Republican and during Backwoods responsible for that. But in any event, I didn't know Vic very much or pay much attention to him during that period of time, while he was serving in the legislature as my representative or a representative. My first real observation of him was when we were both together in the legislature. He was always respectful. He was always, I would say, moderate. Mm-hmm. I don't think you could ever call him a right winger. Mm-hmm. I would call him probably basically conservative, but certainly not of the same ilk as Mabon or Walter Huss before him, or any of the ones since. He was a peacemaker, and he didn't like the division in the party. He didn't like that. He could see the damage that it did to the party, and everybody else could see the damage it's done to the party too. Mm-hmm. But the division still exists, although it may be moderating some. But he always would speak against, and by against I don't mean negatively, but he would always warn everybody about what the divisions in the party, the problems with that, what it would cause in terms of elections of Republicans, and how much trouble it causes to pass legislation and so on. And he was very good, and he's very open about that, and it did bother him a lot. And he had a lot of allies and guys like me and Roger Martin and other people that he ran with and that were in the legislative leadership at the time. Because we saw eye to eye with him. But Vic always used to show up at Dorchester. Mm-hmm. And Dorchester, the moderates call it conservative and the conservatives call it moderate. Right. It's really pretty moderate. But there are conservatives there and there are liberals there, but it's still pretty moderate overall. And Vic was always a very active participant and supporter of Dorchester and its ability to discuss issues and in his terms, and you'll see that in there too, to discuss them with and then make a decision, and there's no blood on the floor. That's what he used to say.
That's great.
And he said that was great. So he used to always support that. Mm-hmm. So my view of Vic as a Republican was that he would never turn his back on a Republican invitation that I know of, be it conservative, liberal, or other kind. People wanted him to come and talk. He'd come and talk or visit, whatever they wanted to do. My guess is that the extreme right wing probably didn't invite him to a lot of functions, but I don't know that for sure. But he showed up a lot. He was very accessible by most anybody. I don't know. I never heard anybody criticize him for having a closed door or turning them down. But
yeah,
not
Peter Courtney's still in awe that as a freshman he was able to walk into his office.
And not only were you able to access Vic would reach out. Vic would go to this Tri-P, he would go to Dorchester, he would go to all kinds of conventions and functions around. He would show up, and he would show up you know, when it was appropriate, he'd show up with Dolores, and they were just a class act, and they were there, and he was sincere, and he would visit with anybody, and so my thoughts of him as a Republican were that he was a very good Republican. He was the kind of Republican that I like, you know, a big tent Republican, one that walked his talk when he said he was a big tent Republican and he didn't believe that there should be rifts in the party. He'd try to heal the rifts, and he would reach out to anybody, whether they were on the left side or the right side.
Mm-hmm.
He'd just reach out to them because it was, you know, Republicanism to him was not, you know, abortion or gay marriage or, you know, the single issue stuff. That wasn't a big idea.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about your impressions of the 82 election. You talked about, so things are beginning to fall apart, and Victor is in the middle of solutions and looks like a problem solver. But in my business and political science, the best model is economics. Economics bad, incumbent in doo-doo.
Well,
pretty clear there.
Pretty clear, yeah.
So 82,
that was
Kulikowski. Yeah, so not only does he win, but he wins by basically a record amount.
But there was a time during that campaign that he wasn't winning.
Right. Yeah.
You want to interview? Are you interviewing Greg Walden?
Yeah, I'm going to interview Greg Walden. I hope I can interview Ted, but he's a little squirrely, so.
Well, interview Greg, because Greg, I don't know if he was his campaign manager.
I don't think he was his campaign manager, but he was in the.
He was certainly one of the insiders.
Yeah.
And he can quote you poll results and things that they did to turn that around. But you know, I wasn't on the inside of that campaign. I was watching it very closely as a lobbyist. We obviously wanted Vic to win re-election. It was a tough election. I guess I wasn't aware that he won with a record.
It was a record that then Kitzhaber beat when he beat Sizemore.
It was a little different than a Tia Kulikowski.
Oh, yeah. Because Kulikowski is a future governor, eventually. Yeah. It was a record victory.
That's good, because, like I said, there was a time during that campaign when it wasn't looking real, real good. You know, but once they got it rolling, well, obviously it worked. But anyway, we breathed a big sigh of relief. When he won, that's for sure. That's a ways back.
Yeah, exactly. Just looking at this, it's like, geez, I wish you would have asked me like 15 years ago. That would have been perfect. But, you know, you do what you do.
Sure. Well, I don't know that my recollection of the time was that most everybody going into that thing, at least Republicans, assumed Vic was going to get reelected. And it was a kind of a wake-up call when they kept getting this news that, hey, you know, it ain't so great. I'm trying to remember what really turned it around. Was it, didn't they say, wasn't there kind of a negative on Kulikowski?
Yeah, there was in fact, because Denny Miles ran the campaign when they got beyond the primary. And so Denny Miles, and I now have the ads. We got them digitized. I have the actual ads. So they called Kulikowski's ideas dangerous. And people took that as Kulikowski is dangerous. So the Kulikowski people are still kind of ticked off about that. And it's kind of splitting hairs. But I'll be able to make the definitive, what do they do? But it was, and Kulikowski then, because he was, As a labor lawyer, and then, you know, in the legislature, he was behind one of the ideas that companies had to notify when they were going to close down or do layoffs.
Yeah.
But they called it, I can't remember what the exact name of it. It was like it was called the plant shutdown bill or something. The name of it sounded like it was what it was actually protecting against.
Plant closure.
Plant closure, yeah. It was plant closure bill. And so they just kept hitting them on the plant closure, and, you know, and the voter, wow, he wants to close plants, you know.
Yeah.
So that kind of stuff just builds up.
Yeah.
But it's just fascinating to me that, you know, it goes against everything in political science about who ought to win the election.
Yeah, but still, he, you know, Vic was almost above that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We
mm-hmm.
I think I'm fairly well grounded, and I don't know that we've had, we may have had people that were just as competent to be governor as Vic mm-hmm. come along. I'm not saying that's mm-hmm. not the case, but there was something different about Vic. I mean, he was kind of above the dirt and the grime that goes on in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even his enemies respected him.
Yeah.
And I don't think that exists today
mm-hmm.
very much. If it yeah. does. But even his enemies respected him. And so, if, you know, when you heard something good about, when there was something in the media that was good about Vic, it probably turned some voters back to him.
Mm-hmm.
Democrat voters
mm-hmm.
who might have been looking for a way to go against him,
mm-hmm.
it might have turned them back toward him
mm-hmm.
because they didn't have any reason to hate him.
Or, yeah.
You know, they were on the fence.
Yeah.
Now, Kulongoski is, you know, and when I was a freshman in '73, Kulongoski was a staffer on the labor committee,
mm-hmm.
and I was on the labor committee, and then he ran for office and won, mm-hmm. and we always kind of got along great too, Ted and I. And he's got probably the best resume of anybody I've ever seen for politics.
Yeah.
And he's a charming guy. I mean, people like him,
mm-hmm.
you know, and when they get to see him. And it's obvious, he's been very successful over time, although he lost that one.
Mm-hmm.
He's pretty good. And for Vic to be able to recover and beat him, even though he was the incumbent, it's still mm-hmm. saying something for Vic.
Yeah.
But Ted, he's got nothing to apologize for. He's been, as far as elected politics, he's been pretty good.
Just don't find that many people who've served in all three branches with distinction.
Yeah, it's, you know, and people can argue about how much distinction there was there, but he's very successful, and
mm-hmm.
I think he knows what he's doing. I was on his committee. Of course, he gets elected, and then all of a sudden he's chairman of the committee, and I'm still on the committee. But he was a good chairman to work with.
Mm-hmm.
He was a very good committee chair.
Mm-hmm.
He did it very lawyer-like.
Mm-hmm.
He was always careful to make the record so that if anybody ever wanted to come back and challenge the record, it was there. It was clear, and he did a good job of that.
Mm-hmm. So Victor leaves office. Impressions of him as an ex-governor?
He stayed Republican, stayed active. Kept coming to Dorchester. We'd see him all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a period of time there when I didn't really have that all that much to do with him when I was still lobbying and working, and he was retired.
Mm-hmm.
He was working in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but once in a while we'd get together, and we'd always see him at Dorchester and so forth. But then, as he got older, and you'll see this in there too, one of the things, there's a group called Political Old Timers,
mm-hmm.
just an informal group.
Yeah.
Roger Martin kind of heads up.
Yeah. I heard the big talk last year was that Victor drove himself.
Well,
to one of those.
He drove himself to some of them, but what's in there, you know, people were asking me about my relationship with him. Well, my wife and I got to drive he and Dolores.
Oh, great.
I'd pick him up sometimes, and I'd just chauffeur him to the lunch.
Yeah.
But then Roger Martin sometimes would say, let's have a dinner. After, you know, that Friday night after we have the old timers, he said, Bob Smith's in town. Let's get together. I'll get the Atiyahs and you guys and Bob Smith and Kay, and we'll go have dinner there at the golf club there,
mm-hmm.
whatever the hell the name of that golf club was. Used to be Oring. No, it's Red Tail now, at the Stockpot restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is. And so we would do that, but then I'd get a call, and they said, can you go pick up Vic and Dolores?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, sure, you know, Gail and I'll go swing by and get them. And so we'd get them, and we'd go over there. And Dolores was, you know, starting to fail.
Yeah.
But Vic was still spry and enjoyed the visits. But, you know, we did that, well, I don't know how many times, not a lot, but
mm-hmm.
three or four times, I guess. And it was a lot of fun. We used to have some great visits. They're just a bunch of old farts reminiscing about the old days. And, and those guys all have more to reminisce about than I did, because Smith had gone off and been in Congress. And Roger, you know, he was in the legislature a long time, and he was one of my mentors. But as a matter of fact, in Vic's first campaign, the primary was, of course, was McCall and Roger and Vic. And I was in Roger's caucus, and so he was my leader, so I supported Roger. None of us probably thought Roger was going to end up being governor, but we supported him because he was a good guy, and we liked him. He was a friend. And then as soon as the primary was over, of course, we all jumped in with Vic, naturally. And it was...
It's like everybody did except Tom.
Poor Tom. He wouldn't have been able to finish out his term anyway, would he? Didn't he die during that period?
Died in 82, so it might have been right at the end of the term. But yeah, it would have been touch and go.
Yeah. But anyway, Vic, I think after he left office, he was a very good ex-governor. He would respond to, he had the same policy. He still had an open door policy, you know, and he'd still reach out and go to things. And if you wanted to get a hold of Vic, you didn't have any trouble getting a hold of Vic. You'd call the telephone number, you'd get Vic. You know, and it was just, it was good. And, you know, I think he did it right. He certainly was helpful every time I ever wanted, you know, him to come to a function or sign something. You know, he was always accessible and helpful.
Yeah, that's great. So, anything else about him?
No, only pretty much what I said there. What I've told you. I don't think I can think of anything else. The one thing I like to the story I like to tell most about Vic and my relationship was, it's in there, but I'll tell you, my boss and I don't know if you ever knew Ray Gribling, but he was he was a longtime lobbyist for Pacific Northwest Bell, and he was the one that got me promoted and to leave the legislature and come to work up in Portland. And anyway, we were a pretty good lobby team, he and I, for that company, and one session, I don't remember exactly which session it would have been, but it was probably something like 85 there and somewhere in there. We were in Vic's office, and I think Jerry was there, and we couldn't get in to see him until about 5. And of course, I'm sure he had a lot of things going, but my boss and I would go in at 5 o'clock, and we give him the pitch on this bill that we were talking about, and I don't even remember what the bill was, but Vic sat there and listened, and, you know, we had small talk back and forth, and he took our message. And then he said, hey, you guys like cigars? And we both said, well, yeah. So he gets out this box of very, very nice cigars. And he holds back, says, here, take one. And so we each took one. And he said, and now get the hell out of my office. That was Vic, though. It was, he had a good time, and so did we.
That's great.
It was, I'm just sorry I couldn't have stuck around a little longer. I would like to have probably spent a couple of more terms in the legislature before I had to come back to Portland. But life is what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, well, thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate you doing this. I wish you good luck. Do you have any time frame that you know when you're going
to ideally, we're publishing next year.
Oh, really?
There's some very interesting, there could be some really good stuff with Victor as kind of the moderate, but basically as you described him, you know, somebody who's seen sides of arguments and making complex decisions as we're going through a presidential election, where that seems to be in short supply. And then also, Vic told me that he could have handled the recession and he could have handled the Rajneeshis, but doing them both was brutal. And the Rajneeshi story from his side has never, ever been told. Hinted at.
I don't recall that ever. You know, I don't associate Vic with the Rajneeshis.
No, but and Jerry's in the middle of it. Jerry's got boxes. Jerry did some amazing things. You know, after 9/11, we were worried about how the different levels of government would talk to each other and all that stuff. She made all that happen. She had federal, state, local, all going through her office, daily meetings, just all sorts of things that
has good.
Never been told.
Yeah. I, you know.
And because Vic says that those were, in fact, the bookends, I hope that I'm talking to Jerry about this, and sometimes she's more amenable and sometimes she's less, but it's got to be in the book. It's got to be in the book.
Are you interviewing Frohnmayer?
Yeah, yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he has a perspective on that, too.
Yeah. Well, she kept daily notes, and he told her, as Attorney General, to destroy those notes because we're subpoenaed. You know, those are out there. She still has a bunch of them. Mm-hmm. And Victor might have them. After his death and just before his death, a bunch of stuff came that's still being sorted through in the archives.
Yeah. That was pre-email, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's all notepad stuff.
Oh, man.
All notepad stuff. I've used some stuff in my classes. I teach a parties and election class every election year. And so in 2012, when I taught it, the class met for the Republican nominating convention and the Democrats were the first of the semester. So we had the nominating conventions going. So we went and looked at Vic's stuff from when he was a delegate. And
we were delegates together once, too. I forgot that.
Oh, yeah?
76, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Back when...
excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No.
That light bulb went on.
But he has these great handwritten notes. He would go into the platform committee and as an Arab American say, you can't do all this stuff for Israel. You have to spread it out. And clearly it never went anywhere. But, you know, my students' jaws just drop.
Yeah.
Because they're just reading the handwritten stuff here and thinking, Republicans? Not supporting Israel? Huh. And so here's this very credible guy who's, you know, all the behind-the-scenes stuff. So
yeah.
It's really great.
Yeah, that's good. Well, good. I'll look forward to getting a copy of it when it's published, and I'll certainly read it.
Good. Well, thank you very much.
Sure, thank you. It's fun to reminisce.
Yeah. Try to remember.